Greetings and springtime benedictions, my multifariously diastatic listeners, and welcome to this March 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this chronically inappropriated science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. First off, an apology to any diabetics out there. I did not mean to mistakenly characterize your disease in last month's podcast. The lovely and talented Ms. Diane Severson-Morey, who should be familiar to longtime Starship Sofa listeners, pointed out to me that diabetics are not characterized as being hypoglycemic. In fact, the disease was first discovered by taste, because there was too much sugar in their urine, and concomitantly in their blood. Diane says correctly, quote, "I'm afraid the result of an insulin deficiency is hyperglycemia or high blood sugar, not hypoglycemia, just like in type 2 diabetes, which is the reason the two very different diseases have the same name in the first place," unquote. I explained my mistake rather pathetically away to Diane by telling her this. I think I did it because a few weeks back, one of my best friends with diabetes went into serious shock because his blood sugar levels dropped precipitously down into the single-digit range. His wife told me that he actually had close to a psychotic episode when he let his blood sugar drop so low. Anyway, I suspect I was thinking of him when I made that statement in the Science News segment. Sorry about that. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. So let's start out the evening with a really cool story. New, highly effective antibiotics on the horizon. Yay! A new study was just published at the end of February in the journal Nature, which describes a new, quote, a new antibiotic that kills pathogens without detectable resistance, at least so far. Dr. Kim Lewis of Northeastern University and her research group made the discovery. Many decades ago, after Alexander Fleming had first discovered penicillin, and it then came into popular use at the end of World War II, Fleming actually predicted that there would be a time when resistant bacterial strains would arise because we were killing off all the sensitive strains. Prophetically, he stated that we would then have serious problems because we would not be able to get rid of those resistant strains quite so easily.
And lo and behold, it came to pass.
Well, widespread introduction of antibiotics transformed medicine, providing effective cures for the most prevalent diseases of the time. But along with those wonder drugs, even just 10 years later, by the late 1950s, there were reports of resistance to the various drugs. Resistance development limits the useful lifespan of antibiotics. And one way to counter resistance is to constantly and consistently come up with new antibiotics. There are two problems with that. First, the drug companies really stopped looking for new antibiotics at some point because they thought that we've got enough antibiotics and they seem to work great, and they slowed down their production of looking for new antibiotics. They're picking this up again, but the other problem is there are limits to how many new antibiotics can be developed at a time. Antimicrobial drug discovery is, well, it's very difficult, and it's due to poor penetration of compounds into bacterial cells. It's hard for scientists, chemists, to develop drugs that will easily enter bacterial cells. The way to get around the problem is to use natural antibiotics that actually evolved in nature to do exactly what we have trouble doing in the laboratory. Natural antibiotics actually evolved to breach that barrier of target bacteria. And most antibiotics introduced in hospitals were discovered by screening soil bacteria that could be grown. The limit on new antibiotic discovery in the recent past has been the inability to grow most soil bacteria in the laboratory. They simply are very picky about where they will grow and how they will grow and under what conditions they'll grow and to what extent they'll grow. About 99% of bacteria grow in soil, and to date, there has not been an effective method to culture them in a lab. This changed recently, however, when Lewis and her research group teamed up with the Novobiotic Corporation to develop a unique growth chamber for culturing soil bacteria. They call the device the iChip, and it enables the growth of bacteria that can usually only grow in soil. Following production of a colony, the bacteria can then be transferred to in vitro culture in the lab the way you do with most other bacteria. Using this technique, the authors identified a new bacterial species and genus. This is Elfteria terra, and it produces an antibiotic called Tertiobactam. Now, take that pronunciation with a bit of salt. Tertiobactam displayed excellent activity against gram-positive bacteria, including Clostridium difficile and Bacillus anthracis. The way it works is by inhibiting peptidoglycan synthesis. Peptidoglycans are sugars that are used to help construct the cell wall of the gram-positive bacteria. Without that component, the cell wall is weakened and the gram-positive bacteria die as it can no longer grow and divide. Although it may seem the breakthrough here is the new antibiotic, it's not. New antibiotics are awesome, but it will just be a few years before our microscopic enemies become resistant to anything that you throw at them again. No, the big breakthrough here is the ability to grow just about any soil bacteria in the laboratory now. That means not just a single new antibiotic, but the promise of a whole string of antibiotics for years to come. This is good news. Next story, electric eels. I remember when I was a kid, I loved going to the Seneca Park Zoo. It sounds like a tiny little place, but it was actually a pretty decent zoo. It's much bigger now. One of the coolest exhibits they had was an electric eel. And it was not just that it was an electric eel. I mean, look at the electric eel, isn't he cute? I remember the zookeeper putting an electrode into the tank with the eel, and the eel actually lighting up a light bulb. I still remember this clearly after more than 40 years, because it was just the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. I mean, an animal with the ability to create electric charges. And I have wondered ever since how an animal can build up that much charge and use it at will. Well, this month in the journal Science, Dr. Kenneth Catania of Vanderbilt University has clarified many of the mysteries of the electric eel and explained at least some of the things I've wondered about since childhood. In the swamps and creeks of the South American river basins, the electric eel lurks in the muddy depths. It's so powerful it can paralyze animals up to the size of a horse with its electrical discharges, and it's been the subject of countless experiments over hundreds of years. And even though it's been around and studied for a very long time, amazingly, we still have very little idea of how the eel actually uses its electric organ to capture prey. We do know that the electric eel is capable of producing three types of electrical discharges. First, a slow, low-intensity mode while it's exploring its environment. Second, pairs or triplets of high-intensity pulses, which have no known use. And then, finally, an all-out high-intensity mode consisting of dozens of pulses over a few seconds to capture prey or defend itself against attacks. A major hurdle to understanding electric eel predatory behavior is that much of it simply occurs too quickly for the human eye to detect. Dr. Catania decided to overcome the limitations of the human eye by using a high-speed camera to track the behavior of electric eels as they try to capture small fish. Catania noticed that very quickly after the eel's first discharge of the high-intensity burst, prey were paralyzed. And the question then became, how quickly does that incapacitation occur? In order to address the question, Catania placed an experimentally incapacitated prey fish into the aquarium, separated from the eel by an auger wall, which, while acting as a physical barrier, was still able to conduct electrical fields. When the eel generated the volleys of high-voltage pulses that it normally uses to capture prey, the prey fish tensed up. However, when Catania injected a drug into the prey that inactivates the connections between the nervous system and its muscles, this response no longer occurred. What that showed was that the eel incapacitates its prey by inducing electrical activity in the nervous system, which in turn makes the muscles contract uncontrollably. When Catania looked more carefully at the eel's predatory behavior, he saw that in complex environments, pairs or triplets of discharges often came before the high-voltage burst. Moreover, the doublets and triplets always produced movement in the prey. Catania asked whether this mode could serve to detect prey under difficult conditions by forcing them to reveal themselves. In order to test this, he put incapacitated prey fish in a plastic bag in the aquarium, which electrically isolated them from the eel. Then, Catania connected the prey fish with electrodes, which allowed him to induce the movement in the prey fish himself, whenever he wanted. Catania noticed that when an eel fired a doublet or a triplet, it would only attack the prey when Catania induced movement in the fish. This presumably shows that the eel uses those doublet or triplets to confirm that it is actually dealing with live prey, rather than one of many inanimate objects in the complex environment that the murky bottom of the swamp might provide. The story elucidates how the electric eel uses its electric organ to draw out, detect, and incapacitate its prey. Furthermore, it comprehensively shows that we should all be grateful that we're not small fish in the Amazonian basin. Next story. Yetis. In 1954, the British Daily Mail newspaper sent a scientific expedition, along with embedded reporter Ralph Izzard, to the Himalayas, and their mission was to track down a Yeti, a so-called abominable snowman. The zoologists found some interesting animals, including a new species of vole, and a scout for the team heard a story from someone who said that they'd seen a Yeti just a few months before. The creature was a, quote, small squat beast the size of a teenage boy, covered with stiff red, brown, and black hair, a flat face like a monkey, no tail, and it could walk on two legs, unquote. The full expedition team later found some tracks and hair and saw something that looked very much like a bear. In the end, there was nothing conclusive. But it also wasn't enough to end the search for the elusive beast known as the Bigfoot or Abominable Snowman or whatever. And the search has continued ever since. You may remember that I told you a story last year about Oxford University geneticist Dr. Brian Sykes and his colleagues. He announced about this time last year that he had found evidence of a mysterious animal in the Himalayas that might be the source of the Yeti legend. The beast wasn't a new species of primate, as had long been conjectured, but a bear. Their evidence was DNA from two small hair samples that matched a short stretch of DNA from the jawbone of a 40,000-year-old polar bear. Scientists immediately began questioning the findings, though, and now a reanalysis of the genetic data by Dr. Elessier Gutierrez of the Smithsonian and Dr. Ronald Pine of the University of Kansas in the latest issue of the journal ZooKeys concludes that there is no mystery bear species in the Himalayas. They compared the DNA from two hair samples attributed to the mystery bear species with that of nearly every known living bear species, except panda, and two extinct bears. The two hair samples instead match the DNA of the brown bear, Ursus arctos, which is native to the area where the hairs were found. There were similarities not to the extinct polar bear species, but to the brown bear and to the polar bear. These two bear species are closely related, which is one reason we can get pizzlies and growler bears. There's a lot of overlap in their DNA. The mystery bear's DNA falls within that natural variation Gutierrez and Pine found. And since there's a rare endangered subspecies of brown bear called Ursus arctos isabellinus that lives in the Himalayas, it's likely that the hair sample came from it, they conclude. Sykes announced last year that he was planning on his own expedition to the Himalayas to search for his mystery bear. After the results of Gutierrez and Pine were published, he's pretty much gone publicly silent on the topic of that expedition. Gutierrez and Pine note that such an expedition would be, quote, a waste of time, money, and effort. There are at least 16 museum specimens of Ursus arctos that were collected from the Himalayas. If there really is a mystery bear species roaming that mountainous region, scientists should start their search by heading to the museum and checking the DNA that's already there. Unquote. So back in January, I reported on a story of why cat bites are so horrible. The upshot is that they are dangerous because cats harbor some seriously nasty pathogens in their mouths. Well, I think it's time to report on the distaff end of things. What about dog saliva? Was Lucy from the Charlie Brown cartoon correct? Are dog germs as horrendous as cat germs? Worse? Well, the answer may be surprising. It appears that when Fido drags his saliva-drenched tongue across your face, man's best friend may be doing you a microbial favor, as well as showing you affection. It was reported in the popular press a couple of weeks ago that the very well-known bacterial biome researcher, Dr. Rob Knight, newly hired by the University of California at San Diego, and his team are recruiting people for a study of whether living with a dog improves the human microbiome. In a press release, he said, quote, "We essentially want to find out, is a dog acting like yogurt in having a probiotic effect? The idea of combining animal, human, and environmental health and seeing the whole picture through the lens of the microbes that we share is an increasing direction for research," unquote. He also states that multiple lines of evidence suggest dog microbiota may have a beneficial effect on people. One of the paradoxes of modern times is that despite the unprecedented cleanliness of the modern West, allergies and inflammatory diseases have increased. The lack of bacteria, most of which are harmless and some even beneficial, may be to blame under what's called the old friends hypothesis. The idea is that humans evolved with bacteria and grew accustomed to them being around. Knight says, quote, "Those bacteria that we call old friends became teachers of tolerance for the immune system. They took over the job of training the immune system not to react to things that are irrelevant, like pollen. There is epidemiological work showing that kids raised with dogs don't tend to get allergies and asthma. So we think that dogs have anti-inflammatory effects based on effects in kids, and increasingly we think now that maybe it's because of sharing the microbiota. There are data that families that have dogs share as much of their microbiota with the dogs as they do with each other." Unquote. Well, dog lovers, take note that Knight specifically refers to dogs and not cats. I guess the cats probably cause more inflammation than they prevent. He goes on to say, quote, "Another piece of evidence is that when the microbiome of people over 65 gets bad, they're much more likely to become frail, get sick, and die. Data suggests that dogs can change people's microbiota for the better." Unquote. Since some of the benefits of living with dogs are doubtless psychological, Knight says that they will have to measure changes in microbiota to help distinguish the psychological effect from the microbial. People 50 and older are being sought for the study. Participants must not have taken antibiotics or lived with a dog in the last 6 months. They will be provided with a dog from the Humane Society to live with for 3 months, and they can choose what kind of dog they want and have the option of even adopting the dog when the study is over. At the start, the gut microbes of the human participants will be non-invasively assessed, along with their diet, activity, and immune system function. Dog gut microbes and activity will be assessed at the same time. Reassessments will take place at the end of the first, second, and third months to determine whether there are any benefits to the microbiome of the people or the dogs. Changes in mental health of humans and dogs will also be assessed. Dogs co-evolved with humans for tens of thousands of years. Scientists generally agree that the symbiosis was important to human civilization. Dogs evolved from wolves, acquiring a predisposition for human companionship and a recognition of people as the top dog, well, at least most of the time. It'll be really interesting to find out from Knight's study whether our coevolution has benefited humans down to the microbial level. The last story of the night involves life extension. Now, we've covered this topic before many times in past podcasts, but let's revisit it again with some new information. As we've discussed previously, It is generally accepted as one of life's unfortunate but inevitable facts that although we might be able to disguise the wrinkles for a time with things like plastic surgery and the like, aging will get us all in the end. Some scientists are now questioning whether it has to be that way, or whether age is simply another disease that might one day be conquered. American researchers have suggested that the elixir of eternal youth, well, or at least extended middle age, may be on the horizon. Two scientists, Dr. Paul Robbins and Laura Niedernhofer from the Scripps Research Institute, report this month in the journal Aging Cell that they have discovered a new class of drugs which they have dubbed senolytics. Senolytics are drugs which delay the aging process. The paper states, quote, "The prototypes of these senolytic agents have more than proven their ability to alleviate multiple characteristics associated with aging. It may eventually become feasible to delay, prevent, alleviate, or even reverse multiple chronic diseases and disabilities as a group instead of just one at a time," unquote. Senescent cells are cells that have stopped dividing, and they accumulate with age and accelerate the aging process. Since the quote-unquote health span, that's the time of your life in which you're free from disease, in mice is enhanced by killing off these cells, the scientists reasoned that finding treatments that accomplish this in humans could have tremendous potential. The scientists were faced with the question, though, of how to identify and target senescent cells without damaging other cells. The team suspected that senescent cells' resistance to death by stress and damage could provide a clue. And indeed, using transcript analysis, looking at RNA expression, the researchers found that like cancer cells, senescent cells have increased expression of pro-survival networks. And that helps them resist programmed cell death, the process of being killed off in a programmed manner by the body. And this finding provides clues or provided key criteria to searching for potential drug candidates. And using those criteria, the team homed in on one or two available compounds. One of the first they found was the cancer drug dasatinib, and another was quercetin. And quercetin is a natural compound which is sold as a supplement, and it acts as an antihistamine and anti-inflammatory agent. Further testing in cell culture showed that those compounds do selectively induce the death of senescent cells. The two compounds had different strong points. Dasatinib eliminated senescent human fat cell progenitors, while quercetin was more effective against senescent human endothelial cells and mouse bone marrow stem cells. And it turns out that a combination of the two is really quite effective. After finding that the drugs had a positive effect in tissue culture, the team then looked at how the drugs affected aging and health in mice. Niedernhofer stated, quote, "In animal models, the compounds improved cardiovascular function and exercise endurance. They reduced osteoporosis and frailty and seemed to extend health span. Remarkably, in some cases, these drugs did so with only a single course of treatment," unquote. In old mice, the cardiovascular function was improved within 5 days of a single course of the drugs. A single dose of a combination of the drugs led to improved exercise capacity in animals weakened by radiation therapy used for cancer. The effect lasted for at least 7 months following treatment with the drugs. Periodic drug administration of mice with accelerated aging extended the health span of the mice, delayed age-related symptoms, spine degeneration, and osteoporosis. It sounds like a miracle, but the authors cautioned that more drug testing is needed before use in humans. They also note both drugs in the study have possible side effects, at least with long-term treatment. The researchers, however, remain upbeat about their finding potential. They state in the paper, quote, "Senescence is involved in a number of diseases and pathologies, so there could be any number of applications for these and similar compounds. Also, we anticipate the treatment with senolytic drugs to clear damaged cells would be infrequent, reducing the chances of side effects," unquote. Interestingly, I find the quercetin angle here kind of funny. I mean, one of the things I've studied over the years is the production of anthocyanin pigments in plants. Quercetin is related to the anthocyanin pigments, and many fruits and vegetables contain the compound, including blueberries, red apples, watercress, sweet potatoes. Now, I'm not telling you to go out and eat a bunch of fruit to stay young, but it is fascinating that many fruits and vegetables that contain quercetin have been connected to anti-inflammatory effects for many years, long before this study. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Have a big bowl of blueberries on me. Let your dog slobber to his heart's content upon you. Keep those insulating rubber boots on you while you walk the Amazon River. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.